A reading from the book of Genesis. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. Joseph came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They've gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you. The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after Jesus had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, he came walking towards them on the sea. But when the disciples saw Jesus walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." Jesus said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." The Gospel of Christ.
Today's gospel reading has Jesus walking on the water of the Sea of Galilee. Our first reading was the story of Joseph, son of Jacob, being sold as a slave into Egypt by his older half-brothers. We can connect these two readings, using one as an example of what the other teaches. If you remember from last week, we read about the feeding of the 5,000. Where Jesus took five loaves and two fish, broke them, blessed them, and gave them to the people there on the side of the lake. Today's reading comes directly after that account. Jesus sends the disciples on ahead by boat while he stays to dismiss the crowd. And then he retires up the hill to pray alone. Sometimes during the night, a storm rolls in with strong wind and rough waters. The disciples, seasoned fishermen among them, are having a tough time making any headway. They have furled the sail and taken to the oars because the wind and waves are against them. They made their way slowly, pulling away from land towards their destination. Meanwhile, Jesus is alone in prayer up on the nearby hill. He has been trying to get away by himself since hearing of the execution of his cousin and colleague, John the Baptist. He had headed away with his disciples by boat, but the crowd followed around the edge of the sea, and then Jesus' grief turned to compassion when he saw them, and we have the account of the feeding of the 5,000. So finally now, Jesus has the time alone to grieve for his cousin and consider his cousin's life, ministry, and death, and perhaps ponder that John's fate very well could be his fate. Sometime after 3 a.m., but before dawn, Jesus heads out onto the lake, not in a boat, but walking on the water. He comes to his disciples in the boat, struggling in the storm. And they're terrified. They think they are seeing a ghost. They know that they left Jesus on the shore when they sailed away. Now, in those days, and especially for the Jews who were not a seafaring people, the open water was considered dangerous and feared. Traditionally, the sea was linked to the chaos that existed before creation. Open water was the domain of chaos. It was dangerous and evil, and seen as the home of cosmic forces. Storms were considered acts of evil spiritual forces. So here they are struggling to keep their boat upright on the waves of a storm. So it's natural that their minds would be turning to the spirit world. And logically, when they see this figure on the water, they think they're seeing a ghost. Jesus is aware of their terror, and he identifies himself to ease their fears. And then he tells them not to be afraid. Now, this is where the accounts of Mark and John of Jesus walking on the water differ from Matthew's. Mark and John say Jesus gets in the boat and the sea calms immediately. The disciples are awestruck. When Jesus calmed a storm at sea a few chapters before, when he was in the boat with them, they were also awestruck, and they talked amongst themselves, who is this person who can command the sea and the wind? But this time, they are awestruck, and then they call Jesus the Son of God. They recognize that Jesus has something they don't. Jesus is intimate with God in a special way and trusted with the command of nature. They have grown in their knowledge of who Jesus is since the previous storm that they had been caught in. Now, I said Matthew's account differs from the other two. In Matthew, Peter has a role to play in the story. There, when Jesus identifies himself, Peter says, "If it is you, tell me to come out to you on the water." And to me, it sounds like Peter is testing whether this apparition really is Jesus. But one scholar I read said, the phrasing of the Greek is such that Peter was not in doubt that this was Jesus. It's more like he's saying, since this is you, tell me to come. So we're left with, why did he ask? Now, we know Peter is a man who speaks and acts before he thinks. Sometimes he'll think later, sometimes I don't think he even thought later. Maybe he wanted to be like his master, Maybe he wanted to express his faith in Jesus' ability. We really don't know why, and maybe he didn't even know why. But Jesus simply says to Peter, "Come." And Peter gets out of the boat and walks on the water. That is faith. There are various definitions of faith. The Oxford Concise Dictionary says faith is reliance or trust in, or belief founded on authority. The book of Hebrews says faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. I think of faith as certainty in something or someone that you can't see, or maybe you don't even understand it or them, but that you trust and act on anyway, as though you could see and understand. You trust yourself to that thing or that person with the assurance that you would have if you had already done whatever it is and it had been successful. And that faith is not just something in your head or something that you say. It is something you entrust yourself to and you act on it. Have you ever walked down a flight of stairs and thought you were at the bottom and then found out there was really one more step to go? You know that heart-jarring feeling when the surface you expect to be there is not there. That shows us the faith we have put in the stairs. We expect them to be sturdy enough to support our weight and whatever we might be carrying. We put one foot down in front of the other, barely even thinking about it. And then, that, you know, one in 100 times, the one we expect to be there is not there. And our faith has been betrayed. We entrusted ourselves to something only to discover that it really wasn't there. Another example for you. Do I have faith that the sun will come up tomorrow? Yes. But I don't leave that as a belief in my head waiting for it to happen to be sure. I act on it. I plan for tomorrow. I make promises to people where we will meet, what we will do, where we will go. I consider tomorrow a fact, even though it hasn't happened yet. Then another one. Do I have faith in banks? Yes. I trust that my account says I have some money in there and that I can go to the bank, ask them, and get it out and hold it in my hand. And I act on that. I entrust money to banks. I do not store cash under my mattress. I believe in the banks. I trust that they will return my money to me when I want it. And when there's a run on the bank, it's because people have lost faith. Did Peter have faith in Jesus? Did he believe that Jesus could keep him above the water, literally? Yes. And he didn't leave that belief in his head. He acted on it. He entrusted himself to it. When Jesus said, "Come," he climbed out of that boat in the middle of a storm. And he found his faith was not misplaced. The water was holding him up. And then it kind of dawns on Peter, his brain catching up with his body, of what the heck he was doing. He was walking on water that was not frozen, and walking on water that's not frozen is not natural. And not only that, but he was doing it in the middle of a storm. I sometimes wonder, like, was he walking up the waves and then like back down the waves, or I don't know, can't figure it out. But anyway, Peter notices the wind and the waves and he gets scared. He starts to doubt. And he begins to sink. I find this expression interesting. He begins to sink, and he has time to cry out for help. In my experience, when you're in water, you just fall through the water. It happens instantly. Here it's like Peter is slowly slipping inch by inch by inch by inch down into the water. He has time to call out. Yeah, it's a short prayer, but it's a prayer of desperation. Lord, save me. You can't get much more succinct than that. And immediately Jesus reaches out, grabs him. He doesn't say, but I'm pretty sure he pulls him up, and then the two of them get into the boat. Jesus calls Peter by one of his favorite terms of endearment, "You little faith." It sounds so condemning when you hear it in English as, "Ye of little faith." You know, pull up your socks, have more faith. But no, in Greek, it's a noun from an adjective, and it's one word. So it's like little faith. Jesus says this to Peter, you know, "Oh, you little faith," as though walking on water is the most natural thing in the world. If he can do it, we can do it. But is that really the meaning of this story? One scholar I was reading pointed out that the early church did not make a habit of going around walking on lakes. And when Paul was shipwrecked, he grabbed some floating wood to hold him up. He didn't stand up and walk across the water of the Mediterranean Sea to get to the island of Malta. I think the message of this account is about Jesus. Not really about Peter, not really about us. Jesus commands creation. God empowered Jesus to control the action of the wind and the water, and even to upset natural laws as we understand them in the process. And that's unique to Jesus. In the Old Testament, control of nature is seen as the prerogative of God alone, God as creator of nature. Then we see Jesus comes to the aid of his friends and his followers. The disciples were struggling in their boat, and Jesus comes to help them in whatever way that he can. Jesus even welcomes Peter's impulsive act of courage. He invites Peter to come to him, and he keeps Peter up when he gets out of the boat. And then Peter gets distracted by the chaos around him. He looks away from Jesus and starts to sink. It could be that Peter forgets it's Jesus who's keeping him up, not his own power. Or he could start to doubt Jesus' ability or maybe his willingness to support him. We don't know. It just says he started to doubt. But the important thing is that Peter had faith. He had some faith. He got out of the boat, for goodness sake. But then he starts to doubt when he sees the chaos around him. It's like his faith starts to trickle out of him, like he sprang a leak. As his faith weakens, it's like his support on the water weakens, and he slowly starts to go under. He must still have some faith, or you'd expect him to just go whoosh right down into the water. I take from that faith is not like a light switch. It's not on or off. We don't have faith or don't have faith. It's more like faith is on a dimmer switch. We can have a lot of faith, we can have less faith, we can have little faith, we can have no faith. And the amount of faith we have varies over time, varies between people, and it varies between what we are putting our faith in. If we believe in God, we have faith that God exists. If we pray, we have faith that God hears, that God welcomes our words and our thoughts. And faith will grow from that small beginning. Like the proverbial mustard seed, the seed is small to start with, but in the proper conditions, the seed puts down roots It draws nourishment from the sun and the soil, and it grows into a shrub that is big enough that birds can come and nest in it. When we feel life's storms are too much for us, we can look to Jesus and cry that simple, desperate prayer, "Lord, save me." Those words are rather generic. It might be that something needs correction, and we could pray, "Lord, fix it." Or something's wrong, and we cry, "Lord, heal it." Maybe I need to hear something, and the cry would be, "Lord, say it." Maybe something needs doing. "Lord, do it." That is the ultimate cry of a believing heart. "I need help. Jesus, help me." And just saying it takes faith. Faith that Jesus is present, that he hears, that he can act, and that he will act. And Jesus here tells us to have faith that he will act. He knows we are little faiths. And he doesn't call us no faiths, but little faiths. And where there is faith, it can grow. And Jesus wants to see us grow in our faith. I said we could connect this gospel story to the one of Joseph from the first reading. Now, Joseph was 17 years old when we read of him annoying a couple of his older brothers. He felt secure in the love of his father and his favorite place in the family. And he's playing a part in the family business of shepherding. Then he went and tattled on a couple of his brothers. Did he do it to make them look bad? I don't think so. I think he genuinely wanted them to shape up and do better. He was just insensitive and indiscreet in his methods. And this was just one example of Joseph's pride and way of upsetting his brothers. Later on, when the opportunity arose, his brothers decided to do away with him. They were alone out in the fields, no one around to witness what they were going to do. There were 10 of them and one of him. It's like Cain and Abel all over again. They could kill Joseph, get rid of him forever. Nobody would know. And I don't think they even thought about the fact some folks would care. The oldest of the brothers, Reuben, talked them into tossing Joseph in a waterless pit instead of killing him. He planned on rescuing Joseph later and returning him to their father. Did he do this out of the goodness of his heart? Oh, no, I don't think so. He too was selfish in his actions. It doesn't say it, but I think he saw an opportunity to get back in the good graces of his father, which he needed to do, because he had gravely insulted him a few chapters earlier. You can go read about it. But then Reuben gets distracted after Joseph is in the pit. And during lunch, Judah talks the other brothers into selling Joseph to slavers. That way they would get something for him, and they wouldn't be guilty of murder. He does say, you know, after all, he's our brother. We shouldn't kill him, but he didn't seem to mind, you know, selling him. I've often wondered what Joseph thought, said, and did during all of this. When he was in the pit, did he call out for help, for understanding and mercy from his brothers? Did he apologize for being so annoying and insulting them? Did he promise them something if they helped him? And what about when they dragged him up and sold him? His brothers would have presented him as probably a troublesome slave they wanted to get rid of. Did he insist on telling them, "No, no, 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 I'm not a slave, I'm actually their brother"? Did he promise those slavers a reward from his father if they would just return him home? Was he so vocal about it that they had to do something to shut him up? If ever there was a time someone needed faith in God, this was one of those times. Joseph was being ripped from home and family, security and safety, and the future that would have been his was disappearing. He was betrayed by his own brothers, essentially kidnapped and sold away to another country. Now we know how the story ends, right? How it all works out. But pretend we didn't. What if we were reading a novel and this is how one of the chapters ended? And you're like, oh yeah, right, I gotta turn the light out and go to sleep now? What happened to Joseph would be the equivalent of Peter sinking like a rock in the water and getting stuck on the bottom of the sea with no one there to grab him and pull him up. Where was Joseph's faith? We read later that God was with him and blessed him. But at this time, when it's all happening, how much faith did Joseph have? And I think he did have faith. He believed in the God of his father Jacob, his grandfather Isaac, and his great-grandfather Abraham. And I think he had faith in the goodness of that God. But now it was definitely being put to the test. Maybe he was a little faith. But that faith grew, little by little, through the hardships he faced. And this was just the first downturn he was to experience before his final elevation to prominence and power. And by the time he got there, decades later, he was a man who could forgive his brothers their betrayal and welcome them back with open arms. Peter's doubt and sinking is a metaphor for real events in our lives, which bring uncertainty, insecurity, hardship, hurt, pain, grief, despair. Joseph's wind and waves were the betrayal of his brothers and the loss of the only home he knew where he was safe and secure in the love of his father. But his faith in the goodness of God carried him and actually grew during those tough times. So what are your wind and waves? What do you see around you in your life that has you doubting the goodness of God? Have you been hurt? Or maybe seen loved ones hurt? Or maybe it's the general evil that exists around us, the wars and violence, the hungry and the hurting, the homeless and refugees, the prospering of the wicked, and the strong man who successfully makes off with the wealth of his country. What tempts you to focus on the problem and not on the goodness of God? God doesn't promise us smooth sailing through life, but God does promise to be with us even in the storms. And yes, when necessary, to reach out metaphorically and grasp us to keep our head above water. And we do know the ending. We know God wins. Goodness is victorious. Justice is established. And things are set to rights. God makes all things truly good. Let us entrust ourselves to that God and keep our eyes on Jesus as we navigate our way through our life and through the storms of that life. Amen.